The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Pat, my next guest was one of five children born to an Irish mother and a Caribbean father. She's author and best-selling novelist Kit Duvall. She's just been elected as a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. And she's joining us to talk about the memoir which recalls growing up in 1970s Birmingham. It's called Without Warning and Only Sometimes, Scenes from an Unpredictable Childhood. And Kit, it has to be said, you have the most unusual childhood makeup because you're Irish, Caribbean, white, black, of Catholic Irish heritage, but Jehovah's Witness practice. It's the biggest melange that one person can have.
Absolutely. And when we were children, obviously you accept, you know, this is just who we are. It's only as we got into our sort of teenage years that you just thought, well, we don't fit in anywhere. Thank God there were five of us because we were our own tribe. You know, even if no one else could understand who we were, we understood who we were. I think if you'd been an only child, you'd have been in danger.
Well, that's interesting because when you read the book, you don't get any sense of you being either culturally at sea or not having a sense of place. You don't feel like an exile in your community, even though it's that very unusual makeup.
Totally. What you learn to do when you come from different cultures is that you code switch. You become really clever. Like if I went to see white Nana, my Irish Nana, I had a different language, I had different words for things, different conversation, different music to the way you speak, even though it's English and Brummy accent. If I went to the West Indian community, talk about different things, different words for certain things, and you just become this sort of chameleon. I know how to behave there. I know what you say, where you sit, how you speak, what you can talk about. And literally just the lilt and the music of your sentences change. Even when I come here, I use different words. It's incredible.
And you pick it up very well in the memoir. You have your mother at one point angrily muttering, "I'm working every hour that God sends." And you think, if ever there is an Irish phraseology of resentment, that's it. But the other thing that is interesting in the memoir is there's large parts of your heritage that as a child, you sort of had no access to. There's a lovely scene where you ask your dad about what it was like living in the jungle.
Yeah. Absolutely. He was horrified. I mean, to be honest, we were taking the mickey slightly, but we didn't know anything about the West Indies. And so we thought, are the mud huts there? And the only black people you ever saw on the telly were in Tarzan. So we just thought, well, maybe that's what it's like in the West Indies. He was so insulted. He was so insulted. And we just never mentioned that again.
The other thing, as if it wasn't challenging enough having the mix of backgrounds, the Jehovah's Witness belief in which you were brought up meant that you laboured under the belief that the world was about to end fairly rapidly. Yeah. The clock was ticking, and that then informed effectively how the family lived.
Absolutely. So Jehovah's Witnesses believed when I was growing up that the world was going to end in 1975 and good people would survive it. But bad people, that's any Catholics, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, anyone that wasn't a Jehovah's Witness would die. Now, obviously, most Jehovah's Witnesses thought they were safe. But I was a naughty child, you know, stole money out of my dad's trousers, fancied boys, had the odd fag. So I thought, well, I'm going to die. And I just grew up thinking I would die before 1975. I would have been 15 at the time. 1976 came, I'm not dead yet. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm going to die, so I might as well go out and have a good time.
Explain how that rippled through the family when 1975 came and went and everybody was still there.
It was only late. That was the, you know, they didn't go, oh my goodness, we're wrong, Armageddon's not going to come. It was, if it's not 75, then it must be 76. If it's not 76, it's 77. And now I think Jehovah's Witnesses believe it's imminent again. I think there's a new date now. So you are always living under this threat of any minute now. And they're still living under the threat of any minute now. I mean, my mother died at 85 and she became a Jehovah's Witness in her 30s. And she was any minute knowing it for the whole of her life. And we couldn't say anything because she'd get upset. But we were like, Mom, come on. You know,
but it's funny. I've just finished reading a book about a cult in America in the 1950s, which was waiting for UFOs to come and take them. And the researchers had actually managed to insert themselves into the cult, and they document it. And there was a deadline. It was 1st of December, I think maybe 68 it was due to happen. But one of the things that they revealed was that the belief is actually strengthened.
Yes.
By the failure of the prophecy.
Yes.
Rather than weakened.
Oh, absolutely. Because what it's seen as, that if you were only worshipping God to a date, then your faith was impaired. So whether that date came or not, here's an opportunity for you to demonstrate your belief and your faith in God, because you've got it wrong. He hasn't got it wrong. You've got it wrong. You've misinterpreted those scriptures. So actually the delay is a boost to the faithful.
You have a lovely description of, I think it's your white Nana and your mother discussing the Jehovah's Witness. And the way you describe it, you say, because it's at the end of a page where they're nudging at, really, do you believe this? Yes, I do. And it says, it's a push me, pull you of a dance. Old as time, the child who was never the favourite, the mother who couldn't love enough. They lock in with clumsy footsteps, out of step to the music, each one trying to lead, stepping on toes.
Yeah.
Did you have to hold back at all in what you put in it? Because there are moments that are hugely revelatory about very personal family aspects. For instance, your dad buys the Austin Vandenpla, a very fancy car.
Yes.
When you simply do not have the money for it and it's a pure selfish indulgence, do you think, maybe I shouldn't say this about Dad?
No, because, I mean, I forgave my father and my mother years ago for their poor parenting. And they were poor parents. There's no doubt about it.
But you would say that openly?
Oh, absolutely. They were poor parents. My mother had mental health issues, but she didn't parent us well at all. She didn't feed us. My father was selfish. He spent his money on fancy clothes, on cars. So they weren't good parents. Did they love us? Yes. They were both immigrants, suffered massively from Irish racism, from racism against black people. They were brought up in absolute poverty. How we were brought up, although we were poor, was way better than they experienced as a child. So you have to look at them not as my parents, but as people. And they were poor. They were living in very straitened circumstances. They probably didn't love each other. They had five very cheeky, very clever children that didn't give them any quarter. And I think they stayed together. They were there. And you know what? In the worst times of my life, they were always there. When I thought I was having a breakdown towards the end of the book, who do I want? I want my mad, bad parent mom. And I run to my mom and she says, oh, never mind. And then she takes me home and my dad feeds me. So when the chips are down, they were there. And that's, for me, what I remember.
The story of the way your mother responded to your distress is also very interesting, because effectively what you ask her to do is just talk at you.
Absolutely. Because I could listen, and she could always talk anyway, obviously Irish. So she could just talk and she'd talk and I would listen. And that was calming. That was like a lullaby to me. My mother's nonsense was like a lullaby. I loved it.
That thing about, though, the way you describe them as bad parents and the kind of criticisms that you would make, the book opens very early on with your total adoration of your father.
Yes.
Following him, literally following him around the house, sitting outside the bathroom waiting for it to flush so
yes.
You'll just have him appear again. Does that adoring bit of you want to quiet down the criticism? Do you have any desire to say, oh, I in some way do him a disservice if I show the other side?
Not to me. I think I was much more interested in being true. And even though it probably comes across as criticism, I sort of see him. I see the man. I see this man brought up in poverty who desperately wants to go home to the West Indies and say, look, I went to England and I made it and I've come home conquering hero. That was his dream. And I think when you see that damaged young boy with his dreams, and then he happens to have five children with an Irish woman who really wants to have 12, you know, he's thinking, I've just got to get away. And I felt sorry for him.
How much does the exercise of going through the memories and reliving them, how much does it inform your life now and your own parenting, if at all?
Oh, I'm terrible about Christmas and birthdays because we were brought up, as I say, Jehovah's Witnesses, no Christmas, no birthdays, no celebrations whatsoever. So with my children, they have their birthday, which is a ridiculously extravagant event. They also have a half birthday. So
what's a half birthday?
Half birthday, 6 months through the year, because it's a long time to wait. So what I do is on their half birthday.
You literally give them a half birthday.
I have a half birthday, both of my children. And so it's a mini celebration. It's a bit of a cake and maybe only one present. But they have, you know, a year's a long time to wait when you're a child. And obviously, I'm trying to give myself a birthday. That's what that's about. That's the nonsense of trying to heal the child.
Do you have any trepidation about the book being out there and so much of your own personal background being out there?
Not really. The people that matter to me, my brothers and sisters, have all given it the go ahead. I only really care about them and what they say, and they love it. So everything else, water off a duck's back.
Marion Keyes in the front of the book describes it as beautiful, vivid and compelling and so moving. And she is not wrong. It is called Without Warning and Only Sometimes, Scenes from an Unpredictable Childhood. And the author is Kit Duvall. Kit, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.